Welcome to Decoding Biosphere, where we ask whether the green thing you just did actually helped or just looked good in a press release.
Today, we're working through posts from Apoorva Goel covering four areas: what ecological restoration actually requires, how renewable energy works and where it falls short, what individuals can realistically do about climate change, and what net zero means when it's done honestly.
Let's start with the difference between planting a tree and actually fixing something.
The central tension here is that tree planting and ecological restoration look similar from the outside, but are fundamentally different in scope. One is a single action, the other is a recovery process for an entire ecosystem.
The post puts it plainly: tree planting is an action. Ecological restoration is a recovery process.
That distinction has real consequences. A site degraded by grazing, drainage, or invasive species won't recover just because seedlings go in the ground. The pressure that caused the damage has to be addressed first, or the planted trees simply fail alongside everything else.
And some landscapes aren't supposed to have trees at all. Grasslands, savannas, wetlands. Planting dense canopy there doesn't restore anything. It replaces one ecosystem with a worse one.
That's a point the post develops at length. Restoration should recover the appropriate ecosystem, not force every degraded site toward forest cover. Natural regeneration, invasive species control, soil recovery, and hydrological restoration are often more effective than planting.
So the number of seedlings in the ground is essentially the wrong metric entirely.
Which brings us to energy, where measuring the right thing is equally complicated.
The renewable energy piece frames a core distinction worth sitting with. The source being replenished doesn't automatically make the technology impact-free or unlimited.
The post draws on the U.S. Energy Information Administration's framing, renewable energy as energy from sources that are naturally replenishing but flow-limited, meaning the source renews, but what's available at a specific place and time is still constrained.
So wind stops, clouds happen, rivers run low in drought years, and biomass is only renewable if harvesting doesn't outpace regrowth.
Right. And the post is careful to separate renewable from sustainable. Solar farms, wind turbines, hydropower dams, and battery systems all require land, minerals, manufacturing, and responsible end-of-life management. A technology can be renewable and still be poorly designed.
Hydropower that severs river ecosystems, bioenergy linked to deforestation, solar projects replacing high-value habitat. Renewable on paper, damaging in practice.
The post also covers storage and grid integration. Solar and wind variability means the electricity system needs transmission, flexible demand, pumped hydro, and batteries working together. Reliability comes from the whole system, not any one source.
By the end of 2025, renewables accounted for about 49% of global installed power capacity, which sounds like progress, and is, but capacity figures don't tell you whether grids and storage are keeping pace.
That gap between capacity and system readiness is exactly where personal choices enter the picture.
The personal climate action post resists the urge to make a tidy checklist feel like a solution. It opens by acknowledging that individual responsibility is real, but shared with governments, utilities, and planners.
The IPCC framing the post uses is useful here. Demand-side action involves individual choices, infrastructure that makes lower emission options possible, and technology adoption. Asking people to drive less is difficult when safe public transport doesn't exist.
Which means the most durable personal actions are the ones that also push on the system, supporting policy, engaging workplaces, and voting, not just swapping light bulbs.
Transport, household energy, food, and total consumption are identified as the highest priority areas. Reducing food waste, eating more plant-rich meals, flying less, and improving home efficiency tend to move the needle more than recycling alone.
But Post also covers carbon footprint calculators, zero waste habits, and electric vehicles, with the honest caveat that replacing every car with a large electric vehicle may matter less than just traveling less.
And those systemic choices connect directly to how we measure success at the organizational and national level, which is where net zero comes in.
Net zero is one of those phrases that can mean almost anything depending on who's using it. So the definition matters.
The Post is precise. Net zero means reducing greenhouse gas emissions as deeply as possible and balancing the small amount of unavoidable emissions with an equivalent amount of greenhouse gas removal.
The operative word being small. This isn't a license to keep emitting and buy offsets to cover the gap.
The Post walks through why carbon credits alone don't get there. Avoided emission credits claim emissions were lower than they would have been, which isn't the same as removing carbon already in the atmosphere. Quality problems, additionality, permanence, double counting, mean a weak net zero claim can look identical to a strong one from the outside.
Deep, absolute reductions first. Residual emissions neutralized with durable removals second. That's the sequence. And reversing it is what greenwashing looks like.
The ideas run together across all four areas today: restoration, energy, personal action, and net zero all circle back to the same principle. The metric you choose shapes what you actually achieve.
Count the trees planted, the capacity installed, the offsets purchased, or count whether the ecosystem is recovering, the grid is reliable, and the emissions are actually gone.
Next time, more from Decoding Biosphere on what those measurements look like in practice.